I'd like to welcome Richard Rhodes. He is the author or editor of 22 books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which won a Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction at a National Book Award, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, and his new book, which will be coming out in October of 2007, Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. Lots of people say that after the dropping of the first atomic bombs on Japan, everything changed, quote-unquote, everything changed. What was the nature of this change, and how was it understood and not understood by the various military establishments that started making nuclear weapons in the succeeding years?
Everything changed because for the first time in the history of the human species, I like to phrase it as a kind of a slogan, humankind invented the means of its own destruction. We finally had what militaries had been striving for a very long time, which was a weapon of so-called war that would basically destroy any enemy if used in a war situation. What we didn't realize at the time, the great and deep irony, the unintended consequence, if you will, of the discovery of how to release nuclear energy, was that that made every country completely vulnerable. Because these new weapons were so relatively small, or would soon be so small, and portable, and relatively cheap in terms of number of people killed per dollar, that it would no longer be possible to have world-scale war. And I think the test of that has quite simply been that since 1945, there has not been world-scale war. That's not to say that the theories that were evolved later, such as deterrence, actually worked. But the point is, what changed is it became no longer possible to fight wars total wars, I should say.
Well, let's talk about deterrence. What does the word deterrence mean, and can it work in the long term?
Deterrence means simply that you have a response that is so devastating that the other side doesn't dare risk attack. Basically, it means that your response, if you're attacked, you still have enough left to attack in return in a destructive way. I think it's important for people to realize, despite all the weapons that were built all across the Cold War, that neither side ever seriously considered using them, even during the Cuban Missile Crisis. When it seemed that we were basically threatening the Soviet Union with a nuclear attack if they didn't remove their missiles and, as it turned out, their warheads from Cuba. I spoke to Robert McNamara, who was then the Secretary of Defense, in the course of researching this book, and he said no political decision that would have caused even one American city to be destroyed with a nuclear weapon was even remotely something that either I or the president would ever have considered. You have to balance that against the incredible arsenals that both sides built to realize that at a fundamental level, what one national security advisor called the level of existential deterrence, meaning basically the feeling in the pit of the stomach that this was something too dangerous ever to use, in any military way. At that fundamental level, deterrence worked and has always worked and no doubt always will work now that we know how to make such weapons. But at the level that the United States and the Soviet Union practiced it during the Cold War, which was to build more and more weapons to balance off each side numerically, to believe somehow that if you had more nuclear weapons than the other side, that you were somehow ahead, deterrence never really worked, because if it had at any point failed, it would have destroyed the very thing that it was supposed to be protecting. So although we found a logic for what was in fact a kind of unending arms race for at least the first couple decades of the Cold War, it was a logic that was imposed on a situation that already existed. It wasn't the basis for that situation. In fact, the first response to the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki by one of the major developers of our Cold War policy, a man named Paul Nitzer, who was an assistant secretary of state later on and one of our major arms negotiators. Nitzer was responsible at the end of the war as part of the Strategic Bombing Survey, a group of experts who were studying the effects of strategic bombing both in Europe and in the Pacific War, and particularly over Japan. Nitzer visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki shortly after the Japanese surrender. We had, at that time, also firebombed all the major and even minor Japanese cities. And what Nitzer saw was that the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was not really different from the destruction of Tokyo or any of the other cities that we had firebombed. And because this, and that was because these were relatively small weapons, and it was, we only used one per city, whereas the firebombing typically was done with more than 1,000 strategic bombers, B-29s, carpet bombing cities and starting firestorms or mass fires. Nevertheless, the level of destructiveness was approximately the same. Nitzer took away from that information the fallacious logic that these were not really decisive weapons, that they wouldn't lead to the end of war. And as he and President Truman and Secretary of State Dean Acheson at the very beginning of the Cold War formulated our view of how you would, from a military point of view, use nuclear weapons in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, he really didn't do the calculation that this was just one bomb and a small bomb in those Japanese cities, and that if bombs got bigger and we had more of them, the destructiveness would indeed be vastly larger than the kind of destructiveness that we had been able to do with firebombing and high explosive bombing during the Second World War. So we started out with the wrong idea. We didn't multiply that one plane with one bomb times those 1,000 planes and realize that nuclear weapons were something like a huge natural catastrophe, or would be had they been used, rather than something like a bombing campaign that could be used to take out bridges and railroad yards and tank warehouses and so forth. It was a totally different, as the scientists say, order of magnitude. And what it meant was, if these weapons ever had been used, as we tried to figure out a way we could use them if we ever had to, had they been used, the destructiveness would have been much worse than our calculations.
You spoke to Robert McNamara, former defense secretary, about why the United States built so many more nuclear weapons than it realistically needed during the Cold War. And he said, each individual decision along the way seemed rational at the time, but the result was insane. What was the nature of this supposedly rational process, and what was the nature of the insanity that resulted?
I don't quite want to let Secretary McNamara off the hook with that remark. I'm not sure that even the individual decisions were quite rational when they were made. Mm-hmm. But he meant something like this, to take a real example. When he was working with the military, with the Pentagon as Secretary of Defense, the question came up of how many Minuteman missiles the United States should build. This was at the outset of the Minuteman program back in the early 1960s. The Air Force wanted 10,000. The Joint Chiefs of Staff took the Air Force recommendation and shaved it down to 3,000. McNamara had his own staff try to figure out how many missiles you would need to destroy enough of the Soviet Union's people and industry and cities that it could no longer conceivably respond. And his team came up with an estimate that 300 would be enough. Now,
and they wanted 10,000.
Well, the Air Force wanted 10,000. The Joint Chiefs were willing to ask for 3. So McNamara's own people say 300 is enough. So how did he resolve this conflict? Because this is, of course, a political problem as well as a technical problem. The Joint Chiefs have influence in Congress. They're not going to accept 300. That's not going to seem enough. and you have to balance all these different competing forces within the government. Well, he and John Kennedy sat down and decided that they could do with 600, that that would be enough. But since Kennedy had campaigned on the argument that there was a missile gap between the United States and the Soviet Union, one of the reasons he was elected was because he claimed that, much to President Eisenhower's fury, because Eisenhower understood that we were building missiles faster than the Soviets at that point, that there indeed was no missile gap. Nevertheless, since the President, Kennedy, had campaigned on that clause, he felt that they would have to ask for more than 600. So they compromised on 1,000. And since there were already 54 Titan missiles deployed, we ended up with 1,054 ICBMs. Now, that's the way that seemingly precise number was arrived at. And that's the kind of so-called rational decision-making process. But I think those of us who aren't in government have to remember, as we think about these things and perhaps feel a little infuriated by them, just how complicated the whole thing is for people who are elected to political office, like President Kennedy or President Eisenhower. You have to be prepared to defend your decisions in military issues against people who know that the easiest way to get votes is to scare the hell out of people. And in a way, the Cold War on both sides, not simply from the United States side, the Soviet side too, the Cold War was about leaderships, whether elected or simply climbed to power within the Soviet system, leaderships that used threat inflation and fear-mongering as a way to power. You can find this again and again throughout the Cold War to just look at the American side. John Kennedy found a missile gap, and pretty soon there was, before that there had been a so-called bomber gap. In the 1970s, President Reagan claimed that detente had ruined us and that the Soviets were actually ahead of us and managed to get elected in 1980 on that platform. So it was a consistent thing that was used by both political parties throughout the Cold War as a way of taking power. Having then achieved election on that basis, then there was the requirement that they do something about it. So we ratcheted up our defense system, basically for domestic political reasons, much more than for international reasons. There was, of course, always a reasonable concern. If the Soviets had so many weapons, then they must at some military level be planning to use them. And we needed to be prepared to defend ourselves against them, if that were possible. So there was a basis, in fact, for having something. But the use of fear and threat as a way of getting elected was a much more powerful driver of the levels of weapons during the Cold War than any real threat from the other side, particularly when you realize that the threat isn't something that you can defend against anyway.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you about, which is what is missile defense, or is there even such a thing as defending oneself against a nuclear attack?
There isn't, and there never was, and there never can be. I quote a British Prime Minister from the early 30s in the context of bombing rather than ballistic missiles, but it's the same argument. Stanley Baldwin told Parliament in the early 1930s, the bomber will always get through. And General Curtis LeMay, when he came back from leading the firebombing of Japan at the end of the Second World War, told an audience in New York basically the same thing. LeMay then was soon responsible for inventing the Strategic Air Command, making it into the huge force of retaliation that it came to be in the 50s and 60s of the 20th century, and always understood that even if you knocked out 95%, a very high number to expect to do, of the Soviets' attacking forces, that would still mean that as many as 75 nuclear weapons would find their way into the United States, and 75 potential cities would be potentially destroyed. There's no way to protect against anything so small and portable as a nuclear weapon. Our smallest nuclear weapon weighed 52 pounds. Our smallest hydrogen bomb, with a yield in the 5-10 times as much as Hiroshima, came to be a device about the size of a wastebasket that weighed about 200 pounds. You can't keep those things that small out. And under those circumstances, you're really whistling in the night to think that there's any military answer to a world where there are nuclear weapons. There is only a diplomatic and political solution to the problem. The great Danish physicist Niels Bohr understood this very early on simply because he understood how destructive these things were. He could do the numbers on the back of an envelope and see how big and dangerous they were going to be. And he phrased it in a single sentence. He said, "We are in an entirely new situation that cannot be resolved by war."
Well, I'm wondering if you could talk about that in terms of the current situation between the United States and Iran, this idea that there's not a military solution to safety and security, but only political solutions.
Yes, and let me speak of it in the context of what Mikhail Gorbachev came to when he finally realized that there was no point in having these vast arsenals on either side. He got the idea from a meeting that was held by the United Nations, a committee of the United Nations in the early 1980s, to try and understand if there was some other way past the Cold War than simply deterrence. And what this Swedish committee came up with was the idea of what it called common security. As Gorbachev would phrase it later in his meetings with Ronald Reagan, "We can't be secure unless you're secure. We have to take into consideration not only our concerns for security, but also your concerns for security. Even if you're our enemy, we have to be sure that you are happy with the arrangements, or you're not going to abide by them, and they're not going to work." So both sides have to sit down, and this to go back to Niels Bohr. Bohr understood even before the end of the Second World War, before the first nuclear weapon had ever been exploded, that these things were so dangerous that the only answer was that they were sort of like an epidemic disease, or would be as they spread around the world. Countries as different as North Korea and the United States have cooperated in the past decades to eliminate smallpox from the world, and are presently cooperating to eliminate polio from the world. And people from either country and other countries are allowed freely to cross borders and to go back into secret places in order to eradicate every last possible trace of these epidemic diseases. There is an example in the public health world where a common danger has led people to sit down and agree that they should cooperate. Well, nuclear weapons are a common danger to the world as well. And if you think of them that way, you realize that we have better reason not to threaten Iran, which is simply encouraging them to move as quickly as possible to develop a few nuclear weapons of their own, but rather to discuss with them how to slow everything down and perhaps agree to reduce our own arsenals in the directions that we pledged we would agree go when we signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's very interesting to me to look back over the history of country after country going nuclear in the first part of the Cold War and realize that every time a country that we conceived of as an enemy approached becoming a nuclear power, starting with the Soviet Union, but then including China and moving on from there, we always had a great discussion of that these were madmen, that they were a danger to the world, that maybe we should go in and bomb their nuclear facilities before they use them. We seriously planned a preemptive war on the Soviet Union in 1954. It was staffed all the way up to President Eisenhower, who dismissed it out of hand and said, "We don't do those things. We don't have Pearl Harbors in this country." We seriously considered bombing China's nuclear test range at Lop Nur in the weeks before they tested their first nuclear weapon in 1968, and so on and so on and so on. And so it doesn't surprise me that the same things are now being said about Iran, that Iran will somehow destroy the world if it acquires a few nuclear weapons, that they'll give them away to terrorists, if you can imagine such a thing. that a country that had built nuclear weapons would give them away to an entity over which it did not have total control? Impossible. And yet that's the sort of thing we are hearing right now with the interest from the neoconservatives and from the Dick Cheney part of our government in perhaps bombing Iran before the end of the Bush administration. Madness.
Madness. You're listening to KSFR, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Richard Rhodes, author of many books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Making of the Atomic Bomb and Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb. And his new book is called Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. For a copy of the unabridged version of this interview, give a call right now, 428-1393. Make a contribution to KSFR, and it's yours. Very interesting conversation indeed.
Very Charlotte.
Yes.
Hey, a couple
hey.
Of people to thank. Cynthia Huss-Bathke. Cynthia, thank you very much for your contribution. Diamond Way Buddhist Center.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. And we are halfway to our $1,000 match.
All
it's
right.
8:39. We have till 9 o'clock to do it. We need you to call.
$500 very, very soon.
Right.
That's five $100 gifts.
Or,
if my math is correct,
well,
or 10 $50 gifts, or quite a number of $35 gifts.
You are brainy.
Yeah, I can't divide by 35.
428-1393 is the number. Please call us now. We don't want to miss out on this $1,000 match.
428-1393 is the number. Hey, Dal, have you been listening to the interview?
I haven't.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. I've been working.
Well, I've been sitting here re-listening to it again and learning more from it the second time. We really appreciate the support of all the people who have already donated, and we are almost done with our fund drive. This is the time to finish it. The way you finish it is by giving a call or by making a pledge online at ksfr.org.
This could be the last day. I don't know that it'll be the last day, obviously, because it depends on you. But it could be the last day. We could be back to regular programming as soon as tomorrow.
We certainly will be back to regular programming very soon. That does not mean go away and come back when it's over. What it means is call now and see to it that it's over. That's what we call taking responsibility.
Right. Help us finish it.
428-1393.
And help us this hour with our $1,000 match. We have $500 to go.
You know what you can do? If you are near the Santa Fe Baking Company, come in and give me a check in person, and I will buy you a cup of coffee.
Hey, that's cool.
428-1393, the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road. We'd like to once again thank our listeners who are listening online. Thank our listeners who are listening in remote sections of New Mexico outside of Santa Fe, which, thanks to Dal Dearman, our new signal is finally able to reach at 101.1 FM. We've got listeners from just about Albuquerque to Taos. Is that correct?
It is correct. And we've had calls from Rio Rancho and from Taos and Rancho to Taos and Cuesta and Corrales and Albuquerque. People participating in the fund drive, they've discovered KSFR. And it's only been a few weeks, really, that we've had 101.1 up. So it's happening. People are hungry for public radio.
That is so very true. And it is a wonderful institution, but it is an institution that is absolutely dependent on its listeners. Unlike commercial radio, this is listener-supported radio. Here we are. Give us a call, 428-1393 or 866-907-KSFR. 907-5737. We're going to hear a commentary now from Ron Bloomberg, and I think one more spot from our beloved underwriters, and then...
Back to Richard Rhodes.
Back to Richard Rhodes.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. So if you had a dinner party and could invite anyone in history, who would you invite? Let's say it's a dinner for six, five other people and you. My five would be James Joyce, Lenny Bruce, Irene Dunne, Moses, and Bill Gates. He might bring a nice dinner gift. Now watch it. Here comes the segue. Hold on. If you think about KSFR as one big dinner party with a group of fascinating people with various interests, some musical, others the art of conversation, those who care deeply about politics, news people, and of course you. You who can pick and choose who you want to listen to and from time to time join in the conversation. It is a 24-hour, 7 days a week, year-round dinner party, and though highly enjoyable, is also somewhat expensive. Now, twice a year, the dinner check comes, and Bill Gates isn't around. It's a check we all have to split. Now, many of us do put in our fair share. Others seem to disappear into the restroom when the check arrives. Now, some may call those people freeloaders. I say they just can't seem to manage to get their hands out of their pockets. But there's always hope that they'll see the light and want to split the check with the rest of us. The number to call is 428-1393. And even if the fund drive has ended, you can still contribute. So call and help us split the check. Or at the very least, be a sport and leave a nice tip. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
You can hear Ron every Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, on Thursdays after the noon news, and Saturdays following Bob Edwards.
Words on Fire. The Santa Fe Short Story Festival is a three-day celebration of story and community. Thursday, October 4th through Saturday, October 6th, writers of all ages and backgrounds meet, exchange ideas, and share stories. On Saturday, bring your family and a blanket to the free story fair on the Great Lawn of the New Mexico School for the Deaf. There's food and a feast of stories, dance, panels, and stilt walkers. For info, call 466-3440 or visit santafeshortstory.org.
One section of your book is called Apes on a Treadmill, and it made me think about the experience of being an ape, and that it's probably a lot easier to understand what or who an enemy is if you're an ape than if you're a politician or a military commander. And I wanted to ask you, what in this point in history constitutes an enemy? A person, a group, a culture, a religion, a nation, a way of life?
I'm not very good at identifying enemies or defining enemies, since I think that the first job of anyone in a position of responsibility in government is to look at the real reasons people do what they do. Let's take the current enemy of choice, the terrorist. You know, we fought against an enemy during the Second World War, the Japan, that had what we would presumably today call suicide bombers, meaning the kamikaze pilots, who were all young, so-called fanatic young people who were willing to use their life to take out a lot of American lives on ships by flying planes that were essentially flying bombs, didn't even have wheels for the return flight because there was not going to be a return flight, flying them into our ships and causing mass havoc and terror among the Pacific Fleet at that time. Those people were doing something that's fundamentally rational from their point of view. And horrible as it is to say, I think we have to understand that terrorists are as well. They're simply leveraging their very small power against our very large power in the only way they've been able to figure out to do. I'm not condoning their violence any more than I think one should condone our violence in Iraq. People don't act from pure, irrational, fanatic motives. They usually have at least a sheen of rationality about what they think they're doing. We certainly have tried to find a rationale for what seems to me to have been a most irrational war against Iraq. So if there is an enemy right now, it's certainly, I guess an enemy is properly defined as someone who wants to kill you. And that's certainly true of terrorist groups that have been fighting us in various ways. The question is, how do we put a stop to that? And I think the answer pretty clearly is you don't stop violence with violence. You simply don't. You escalate violence with violence, particularly when the people who are using the violence against you are not part of a centralized system of government. Governments control the violence within their jurisdictions more or less well, depending on how well they're organized. But if you're not a part of any organized government, as the Al-Qaeda groups are not, for example, their kind of violence is basically retaliatory violence. It's based on an old system that used to obtain in the West and still obtains in some parts of the world, where if someone attacks you, then you attack them. If you can't attack them, you attack their brother-in-law or their cousin or someone within their family or within their group, their tribe, whatever. That's the kind of system the terrorists are working under. And it's not going to work to attack them that way, because that simply means they feel they have to retaliate. Better would be to try to figure out what it is they need and then figure out what we can give them that they would accept and that they might give us in return some surcease from this particular threat.
I've often wondered about the cultural differences between people working in the world of weapons, especially nuclear weapons, and the rest of society, many of whom see, all the things you're talking about, even the words, you know, the need for nuclear war or the need for using these kind of weapons as absurd or psychotic. You've been far closer to it than I or probably most of our listeners have ever been. What is the culture of weapons people like?
People at our labs, such as Los Alamos, or people in our military, are people who have accepted a responsibility that is handed to them by the government that we elect. Under those circumstances, I think they deserve all honor and credit. They're trying to do a job. If we have questions about whether that job is right or even good, it might well be an evil thing to do. The job comes from those people whom we have elected as our leaders, and they are the ones who should be held responsible. That said, I think whenever you find yourself working in a world that is protected from the rest of the world by a layer of secrecy, which is true with the labs and is true with the military where nuclear weapons are concerned, the risk always is that you become isolated and lose your connection with the rest of the civilian world, lose your sense of what is appropriate and inappropriate. It's very wonderful that former leaders of government, like the secretaries of state and others whom I mentioned, who are pursuing a program now of nuclear elimination, it's wonderful that they are, but it's also very interesting that they're all former government officials. Because when you're in government, basically, you have to follow the policies of your leaders. The irony is that the leader, whether it be Joseph Stalin or President Eisenhower or George W. Bush, leaders typically take their authority or claim to take their authority from the people. So you have a kind of circle where nobody is responsible.
Right.
The leader says, well, I'm here because the people chose me, or I'm here because the people wanted me to be here, I'm here because I found my way here, in the case of dictators of various kinds. But they evoke a larger principle, which is rather amorphous and which doesn't get to say no, as their authority for doing whatever they do. And then as you go down the line, the authority leads up to the people at the top. You're left with a situation where no one is really in charge in a terrible way, because some of the decisions that are made may well mean the destruction of a whole way of life, indeed the destruction of a whole group of people. So it's particularly tricky when people are responsible to up a hierarchy, up a chain of command, but ultimately the people at the top are the people who are responsible.
There's a significant portion of people in the United States who believe in the apocalypse and in the rapture. Does apocalyptic thinking play a role in the politics of nuclear weapons?
It certainly did in the case of Ronald Reagan. And it's very curious. You know, when he and Gorbachev came together at Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, at their famous two-day summit in October 1986, just 21 years ago, both of them arrived there with the full intention of figuring out a way of ending the nuclear arms race, which I think they basically did, but with the hope that they might somehow actually begin the elimination of all the nuclear weapons in the world. And Gorbachev came with his idea of common security, that the best way to be secure was to make sure your enemy was secure. That was the basis on which he could see slowly reducing or rapidly reducing nuclear arsenals. Reagan came with a very different perspective, and it might seem bizarre, but it gave him a basis in deep basis in belief, and that was he had long ago equated the battle of Armageddon that is predicted in the book of Revelations, the last book in the Bible. He had long ago equated the battle of Armageddon with nuclear war. And he had come to believe that he was put on this earth, particularly after the near assassination that happened to him early in his presidency, when he barely survived, as we now know, he woke up from that horror saying, well, then I must really have been put on this earth to do something important because God saved me for that, so that I could do it. He thought that if we could eliminate nuclear weapons, we could prevent the Battle of Armageddon from occurring and therefore prevent the end of the world. You may not have noticed that that also would mean he would have prevented the second coming of Christ, but that's another question. Right. The point is, this deep belief motivated him in his movement toward eliminating the idea of eliminating nuclear weapons. So, oddly enough, Armageddon and the notion of a rapture and all those things, which he was fully aware of and a believer in, motivated him to try to do something that would have been absolutely wonderful for the whole world, in my judgment. And which we're now slowly beginning once again. The George Shultz group actually took its lead from the Reykjavik summit. Shultz was there and was advising the president at that time. And it was in honor of the 20th anniversary that this idea that we should take the lead in developing a treaty through the United Nations that would eliminate all the nuclear arsenals, that's where the idea emerged from. So Reykjavik is still very much with us, whatever the motivation of the two leaders who negotiated there.